For redistricting, I do have one letter for the record from Frank Brawner urging you to reunite Tillamook County when you redistrict. So we'll have that in the public record. Anybody here want to talk about redistricting? Okay. Guys are missing all the excitement. In order, we changed the order slightly. Senate Bill 505 will be first, 2458 second, 487 third, 40 is fourth, and 955 will be last. So we will get that to end. So let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Scott.
Chair Harper, members. Chair Harper. Chair Harper, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Tye, Operations Manager for the Elections Division, Secretary of State's office. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you on the proposed changes to the signature verification process. Senate Bill 505 adds provision to the current initiative and referendum election law to require the Secretary of State to, upon request of a chief petitioner, verify all signatures on a petition. When a completed statistical sampling process determines the petition does not have enough valid signatures to qualify for the ballot. Observations that we have concerning this bill are the Secretary must maintain a list of individuals who are qualified to conduct verification of all signatures on a petition. Also, the Secretary and the Chief Petitioners must agree on individuals selected to conduct the verification. If the full verification determines that there are required number of signatures, the Secretary shall accept the result of the verification, accept the petition, and pay the expense of the verification. If the full verification determines there are not the required number of signatures, the Secretary shall not accept the results of the verification, shall reject the petition, and the Chief Petitioner shall pay the expense of the verification. As we analyze this bill, we would like to suggest to the committee that there be an amendment to this bill identifying the county elections officials as those qualified individuals to conduct the signature verification. Second, the Secretary constitutionally has 30 days to verify initiative petitions submitted for verification. A full verification of an initiative would exceed the constitutionally required 30-day verification period. We looked at costs. For the estimated cost for an initiative petition containing 130,000 signatures, and that was the average of all initiative petition submitted to amend the Constitution last election cycle. The estimated cost for the county elections officials to verify those would be approximately $97,500. This estimate is based on a verification rate of 20 signatures per hour at $15 per hour for the person doing the verification. This would not include the costs associated with tracking duplicates and increased costs to perform the required county coding and tallying of the signatures. The Elections Division is confident that its statistical sampling is accurate. The odds of a petitioner will end up paying the costs are much greater than the odds the Secretary of State will pay. Currently, there can be up to 3 chief petitioners sponsoring an initiative petition. We again would like to suggest an amendment requiring that all chief petitioners request the verification of all signatures on an initiative petition. Also, we would like to suggest that an amendment would require a security bond be posted prior to conducting full verification of the signatures. That's the end of my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Charles, why don't you come on up? You're next anyway. The bill sponsor isn't here. What do you think the problem is? Why are we hearing this bill? What, either one of you? I can't speak for Senator Miller, obviously, but what do you think's driving the train here?
Chair Harper, I can only speculate, and members of the committee, I can only speculate that in that rare instance where you may have a petition that's close to the line on either being accepted for placing on the ballot or rejected, that if there is a challenge to the statistical sampling formula, that the chief petitioners may want to go ahead with a full verification. I don't know whether that's the intent or not.
Jump right up in here. Wasn't us. We didn't do anything yet. How can we be in trouble?
Yeah. Well, you've already
caught it.
Already in trouble?
Golly, 5 minutes into the hearing, I'm in trouble already. Geez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ed Dennis. I work for the Secretary of State. I had a meeting with Senator Miller, the sponsor, and the new elections director, John Lindbeck. And Senator Miller suggested that it was a fairness issue, if it's pay to play, sort of. If they want a challenge and they win, then the state should pay for it. It was actually the Secretary of State's office should pay for it, and vice versa. And he also suggested that there may be a benefit because it may sort of, I'm paraphrasing here, but it may sort of cut down on the sort of complaints around the statistical sampling. If there was this sort of real put up or, he didn't say this, I am, put up or shut up solution to that scenario where somebody feels like the statistical sampling wasn't accurate. So, and by the way, we ran all these proposed amendments. Yeah, we ran all of these past him.
And okay, I said I'm just trying to get a background here, so I appreciate that.
You bet.
Okay. Any other thing for Scott? Charles?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Amhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. We are not overly excited about this particular bill for a couple of reasons. One, we'd like to look at the window of time in which this activity occurs. Right now, the Secretary of State is processing the petitions that are coming in. If they suddenly get a request from a petitioner who early on had submitted his petition and was determined by this statistical sampling not to have sufficient signatures, what would be the priority? We'd go back and check all of them when we are maybe checking signatures for those who still are in the pipeline on the statistical sampling in that narrow window of time that we're working with. So that's a real concern on the part of the clerks. How to establish the priorities of how the workflow is going to occur. The cost is a big item. Currently, the Secretary of State does not, it bears the cost, but the cost is nothing because the counties do the checking and the Secretary of State doesn't pay us to do that now. And I don't know if the language of the bill fully says write a check to the county. It just says you bear the cost and there's no cost to the Secretary of State at this point. And so that would be a concern for the counties is if there wasn't that check that came along with it. We also share the concern of that the petitioner should post a bond so that there is the assurance of that larger sum of money will be available. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Anybody else on 505? Where's what?
Is there an amendment?
No. There were some suggestions from the testimony from Secretary of State.
I thought I'd lost it already.
Yes. All right. With that, we will close the public hearing on 505 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2458 Alpha. Representative Schrader.
Uh-oh.
Would you like to bring an entourage with you, or?
I am the entourage, sir.
You are the entourage.
We should be.
I'm sure there'll be others following, though.
We should be so lucky, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you here on Senate Rules. Bring a House bill, House Bill 2458, from your neighboring body. This bill is fairly straightforward, has had a long history, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time going through that with you here. A similar bill was initiated by myself last session, passed the House fairly overwhelmingly, passed the Senate overwhelmingly, and unfortunately the governor couldn't quite see his way to signing the bill.
He vetoed one of your bills?
Well, that did happen on occasion.
I'm so happy.
In fact, I may have more vetoed bills than you.
He's an equal opportunity vetoer.
Equal opportunity vetoer.
Having taken his admonition to heart, we developed an interim work group at which he was a member. and thought maybe we could do it a different way, and indeed we have. His biggest concern was, this is about incorporation, and specifically incorporating within 3 miles of urban growth boundaries. The original bill that he vetoed also took away the veto rights, if you will, of those cities within urban growth boundaries. We have since changed the bill to take care of his concern. And so at this point, I think we're in very, very good shape. The bill generally, I'll give you a little quick editorial on what goes on here. It's basically an issue of fairness. Should a neighboring city have absolute dictatorial, unilateral ability to prevent citizens outside of their jurisdiction from determining their own destiny? That's bottom line. That's what this is really all about. On the other side of the coin, those cities will say, well, geez, you know, we may need to grow and expand to accommodate population. We need to develop a commercial industrial tax base. So we want to have some way to have some verbal discussion over how we grow and develop. And this bill does just that. It serves both purposes. It preserves that right within the city's UGB and provides for a discussion process that, quite frankly, is heavily weighted on the side of existing cities and allows them to go ahead and have access to information that otherwise they would not. Currently, the way the law reads, local people outside of urban growth boundaries that want to develop their own cities are unable to. Why are they unable to? Number one is they need to usually do an economic feasibility study to decide, is this really right? Do I want to build myself into a taxing jurisdiction and face potentially higher taxes for urban level development? And the question then arises is, well, how are they going to study? How are they going to figure out if this is something they want to do? I had a situation arise in my community, town of Beaver Creek. Town of Beaver Creek was facing a situation where Metro was going to expand their urban growth boundary and was looking favorably upon annexing them. That galvanized the citizenry into an intense discussion about, do we want Metro to determine how we grow, develop, and look, or should we actually look at incorporating? And I, of course, was skeptical of what they thought of when they thought of incorporating. Is this another martini farm? Although my people in Clackamas County are more beer drinkers than martini drinkers. But is this the type of community you anticipate? And the answer was no. The answer is no. We understand this is about urban level development. We're going to go there, you know. But we would like to have the right to plan for our own community. And they tried to access different monetary resources with LCDC, the county, neighboring cities, Economic Development Department, and they were unable to do so. And the reason they were given is, well, until we hear from Oregon City or other cities within 3 miles that they're not going to veto this, I don't want to spend our precious money helping you find out whether or not you want to do it when they could veto that. So we got into this catch-22 situation, and we needed to move forward. As a result of that, I began to think of ways to help facilitate their ability to get that economic development grant or whatever to begin that look-see at incorporating. And it came to me that, well, geez, maybe those cities shouldn't have an absolute veto, but their rights need to be protected. And what you see in this bill here is as a process that they go through. The citizens would look at incorporation. They would have the ability to do this feasibility study. They'd have to meet urban level standards, as you see in the bill here. They'd have to plan for that, all the amenities that are needed, either by themselves or contracting with other purveyors or providers in the adjacent areas. And then if those citizens, after doing that study, say, yes, I think this looks good, we do want to go ahead with incorporation, they file the petition. At that point, the cities are free to say, hey, we have no concern over this, just go right ahead, do what you need to do, or they get to intervene, and the discussion is held at the county court level. That's usually the county commissioners. At that point, there's a discussion process that goes on. The county commissioners decide yay or nay on one side or the other. And then at that point, if either side still feels that they didn't get their day in court, with quotes, they can appeal this to LUBA. And LUBA would make a final determination. And the reason I go through that litany is to show that, quite frankly, the existing city's rights are still very protected. I find it hard to believe that the existing county and LUBA would rule that a new city should develop that would actually hurt, would hurt the ability of another city to expand and develop. So the name of the game, I think, here is to come up with something that's reasonable, that works, and allows people to go ahead and do what they're supposed to be doing, which is empowering themselves and deciding the fate of their own communities. And this bill just, frankly, does that. I think it has a side benefit by incorporating, at least in my neck of the woods, on existing urban areas. It may not be called a city, but it's already an urban area. Redland, you know, Beaver Creek. There's tons of small communities, Merlin down in the southern part of the state, that need that are basically already urbanized and never going to be farmed. If we have excess population, do we need to expand out onto the better farmland, or should we be looking at new satellite areas where population should be going? And so this provides for that. It's a good land use bill at the same time, providing the self-determination. All right, I'll cut to the chase, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. Been working on this for 3 years. Interim work group agreed on the first bill. We had some discussions on the House side, decided to do some more amendments. That has proved somewhat interesting, and everyone has a slightly different idea of what a particular word means. We have submitted the -7 amendments that hopefully you have before you. These -7 amendments have the blessing of all the original partners. That would be the DLCD. That would be Metro, got them on the phone. Associated Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities. They're okay with these amendments. This amendment's just, these amendments are fairly technical compared to the House bill that we originally came up with. They basically tighten up the language so that these areas would be on exception areas that have rural centers. It provides language that does not give overwhelming power to a state agency to determine density, but recognizes that these communities have to be at urban level type densities. And then the last comment in line 20 basically says that proposed city doesn't have to provide all the amenities by themselves. They can contract essentially with county service districts or special districts. Special districts are very interested in that, as was my own county. So that's what the amendments do. Everyone seems to be on board. It's been a long, interesting process. I learn every session I'm here, and welcome any questions or concerns.
Thank you, Representative. Question I have is, will Schraderville be inside Sinceri County?
No, this...
Outside?
I'm not sure how to answer that, Mr. Chair. This has right. Statewide effects.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schrader, just to be clear, the A7 amendments are okay with you?
Yes, they are. I support the A7s.
Mr. Chairman. Okay. Question. While you guys are doing your thing. Representative, trying to sort out some objections to this bill that were faxed to me by the mayor of Gresham. And I'm looking at two different letters from him, but one portion of the discussion that he and some other mayors had with you about this bill applying to newly incorporated cities outside of the urban growth boundary. Does the A7 amendment accomplish that, make it applicable only to?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So he'll be happy.
Any further questions?
Well, not that I can intelligently utter.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry,
The note that I passed, Senator Harper, was my question. about Schraderville.
Okay.
Thank you.
Glad to raise the level of the conversation here. Representative Schrader, my question is, there were 8 no votes on this bill. We've hardly even seen a bill this session with that many no votes. What's going on? Seriously, 8 no votes.
8 no votes. Yeah, it is high for us this session. We're at the Kumbaya session here, except for today on the House floor, but that was entertaining. I don't know. I think there were some concerns that any change in land use planning might be not good. But I think at this point we're dealing with Measure 7, folks. It's time to think outside the box, time to be realistic. And is there a way to deal with people's apathy, anger, and concern about our system in a productive way that moves the process forward, engages them without putting our land use system at risk? This small bill does just that.
Would B.J. Smith and Doug McClain please come up? And Commissioner Kinnear, did you wish to join us, or are you just here to... Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm B.J. Smith. I'm the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. And I have with me our planning director from Clackamas County, and it is just to give you a couple of comments that we have on House Bill 2458. We were not identifiably involved in the work group on this, and so we have been looking at interest with the various amendments that have been coming out. I think that in general, the policy and the intent around this bill is excellent. It really tries to deal with some fairly difficult urban problems, particularly in Clackamas County and in the urban area. And it deals certainly, I think, well with the idea of trying to make a reasonable incorporation decision for a community that is close to all the many cities in the metropolitan area. But we did have two issues that we wanted to talk about that have really surfaced in the last couple of days. We had some concerns with the original bill that came from the House in the amendment language that had to do with the minimum density requirement in the bill. And the other issue was that we have a particular area in Clackamas County that was at one time, it is a rural community, and it was a part of the urban reserve area that no longer governs the future of that rural community. But that community is close to the metropolitan urban growth boundary, and at this point in time it is outside of the boundary and might be subject to the application of this bill, but 2 years from now the urban service boundary of Metro might encompass that area. And we had actually been working on some amendments that would allow and make it clear that the provisions of this bill would apply to that particular rural community if it should wish to incorporate under the provisions. Now, those amendments are in LC. They're requested, but they are not available as of the time of this hearing.
Is Representative Schrader aware of those amendments?
Yes, I have talked with him. I talked with him for about the last 2 days. It was quite difficult. We've been talking since February about trying to get language around this, and a couple of days ago we thought that we had some language, but I think it just did not get ready for this hearing.
Was he okay with the amendments?
This morning, the idea, the problem is the language.
Okay.
It was my understanding that the idea was one that he was comfortable with. He's still here?
He is. Yeah. We're getting signals. We're getting
okay. Are they yeses or are they noes?
When you, both of you are done.
Okay. Chair, it's all yours.
Senator Beyer.
BJ, thank you, Mr. Chair. BJ, have you seen the A7 amendments?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, I too picked them up in Representative Schrader's office about an hour and a half ago, so we're looking at them.
You have your planning director with you?
I have my planning director, and he's seen them for a couple of minutes, and we just wanted to talk about the language there on the minimum density.
I was curious if you thought that this kind of it's a change from the bill, and I was wondering if you thought this addressed your concerns.
Mr. Chair or Madam Chair, can't figure this out. Senator, yeah, Senator Biden. This is better than the original bill that came from the House. The language in the Dash 7 is, in our judgment, better language. But we still had a couple of questions or concerns that we wanted to put before you on the Dash 7 language.
Madam Chair, my name is Doug McClain.
Senator Menace had a question.
Hold on. I was going to try to just ask that. I don't want to speak first.
I think he's still working on mine.
Okay, Senator Beyer, my name is Doug McClain. I'm the planning director for Clackamas County. Again, I think BJ's summation is correct. The Dash 7 amendments are an improvement over the earlier bill. We had some fairly serious concerns about imposing statewide minimum density standards in a local community. The language here is an improvement. Again, we've had a very short time to review it. I do have some concerns with the first couple of phrases. The way I read it, it would require a new city planning to incorporate to plan for an urban density the same as an existing city with a similar geographic area. I'm not sure exactly what that means. If, for example, the area around Beaver Creek was interested in incorporating, would they pick Milwaukee because that's the same general square mile area, or would they pick Molalla, or would they pick Johnson City? And obviously the results are extraordinarily different depending upon which of those cities are chosen. So it's a little unclear to me how this particular provision would work, and that's the one concern I think that we have. The second part of the phrase is as far as providing a minimum urban residential standard to cities within 3 miles of Metro's boundary. Metro's boundary actually is much different than Metro's urban growth boundary, and I think one improvement would be to insert the phrase Metro's urban growth boundary, because Metro's boundary actually extends in Clackamas County out almost to Boring, which is, and if you were to apply the 3 mile standard beyond that, you'd be encompassing quite an area. So I think it would be an improvement to say Metro's urban growth boundary instead of just their boundary. Also, I presume the language here is meant to apply the statewide Metro housing rule, which does establish minimum densities. It's a state rule peculiar to Metro, and is probably appropriate for areas that are included within Metro's urban growth boundary, and I'm not sure that we'd have a particular objection with that.
Senator Menace.
Mr. Chairman, it's kind of in 1985, when I was first appointed to this legislature, I sat on a committee where we spent literally 3 months working on an annexation bill where people nitpicked this silly thing to death. And Fred Neal's not in the audience, but he staffed it back then. And it never did go anywhere, the whole bill. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm ready for a work session. Let's just do this thing, put it in law, and you all can come back next time. Tell us whether the doggone thing worked or not.
Hey, Chandler, are we okay? Are you going to burn my house down if we pass this thing? Thank you.
Here comes the singing comedian.
You're appointed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Land Use Specialist for the Oregon Building Industry Association. Want to express my appreciation to Representative Schrader. This was a bad on me bill because I kind of forgot to pay attention to the amendments in the House. And then I bugged last evening when I saw them, talked to the representative. He's made significant changes, and we are fine with the Dash 7 amendments. And I do appreciate his tolerance and his not taking a ball bat to me, which he probably felt like doing. But then it's not like that before, off and on. Be glad to answer any questions.
Are you going to burn my house down if we
no,
pass
sir.
This bill? Okay. Yes, Senator Beyer.
John, looking at the comments that Mr. McClain just made, Is the appropriate language of Metro's urban growth boundary? I think they're speaking to line 9 after the word Metro.
My God, look at the time. It's awfully late. I got to get going.
For those of us,
can I step to a different house, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I've never made any money arguing with Mr. McClain. I think he's I would defer to his interpretation. I'm not sure that I haven't thought that one through, and I could mumble for a while longer, or I could just stop.
Maybe we'll ask Representative Schrader. This is going nowhere, Mr. Chair. Thank you for sharing. Representative Schrader. So all we know now, Mr. Chair, is that we don't think John will burn your house down.
Well, that's going something.
Yeah, closer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to come back up. Kurt Schrader. A couple of comments, if I may. Number one, the wording that we're discussing there has come from LCDC and from our own LC, and it has been extensively looked at, researched, and while it may not be perfect, is probably as good as we're going to be getting to satisfy the concerns of those involved. I would point out that it is the second portion of that particular section we're amending that we'd be applying to Beaver Creek. We look carefully at the definition of metro as in the statute, how we could reference that, and this would apply to the Metropolitan Service District in Portland. It's fine. This language works.
So it's the right reference?
It's the right reference, and it works.
So for the record, this means the Metropolitan Service District?
That is correct, in Portland.
Which is a larger boundary, isn't it,
than the urban growth boundary?
That is the urban growth boundary. Metro's boundary is the urban growth boundary.
It is the urban growth boundary.
You're getting a disagreement.
Well, it's...
Yeah.
Right. Growth boundary.
I don't care. I think we know which one we're talking about.
Right. It is the right reference. I worked with Elsie and Bob on this thing.
For the record, Representative, do you mean the metro boundary or the urban growth boundary of Metropolitan?
Part of it is within 3 miles of Metro's boundary, and then the statewide planning goals needed is within Metro's urban growth boundary.
Okay.
Right. And the reference for the statewide goals is Metro's housing goal?
These would be statewide planning goals and rules.
That's only applicable to Metro.
I don't think there is one for minimum.
Goal 10.
Huh?
Goal 10.
He's right.
Okay.
In reference to Clackamas County's concerns, I have tried to work with them. This morning I tried to incorporate, once again, some concerns they had, and I got a call back later this morning from LC that they could not get this particular wording in this particular draft. I don't know why, but I got a call they couldn't do that. I have offered to work with Clackamas County to draft another bill that can address their concerns this session, next session, whatever. Well, this session for me. I'd be glad to co-sponsor that and bring it forward and try and make it work. But this has been actually, as you can hear, very complicated. While on the surface it's simple, it does some really great things for a lot of different people. To add more to the mix would make it, I think, unwieldy and untenable and not get through this body.
Let me ask once again, just because we don't deal with this, Metro's boundary is something different than Metro's UGB?
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay. And that's okay with everybody. That's what it means. That's what you mean for to me. All right? Okay? All right, we'll close the public. Anybody else? I mean, it's not aimed at you. Anybody else want to go before I gather down here?
I'm not sure if we're in the water or not.
Where's the gong?
Where's my gong?
You can tell how complicated this is when you get people that weren't going to speak and then do. Mr. Chair, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I, too, want to thank, at this point, Representative Schrader for working on this, because we had some concerns which the DAS-7s address. And we are supportive of the DAS-7s with the clarification that we're looking at the Metro's UGB. That was at least the intent of our input into drafting the language at this point.
That's not what he said.
I understand.
What this means.
I understand. But I just want to get that at this point on the record, and if you pass the bill, then you pass the bill.
Okay. Yeah, I just don't want my house burned down. What's the big deal, Kurt? What's the big deal with this boundary versus UJ? What are we talking about? How far apart are they, or what?
You referred to the two Portlanders.
Yeah.
Metro's boundary is bigger in some respects than the urban growth boundary. So I'm deferring, trying to go the extra mile here for those that are concerned about the fact that cities, existing cities within the metropolitan area. Yeah. And if there is a concern, I would point out that since we are amending the bill, there will be some sort of conference discussion, I assume, to go on, and we can address those concerns if indeed someone has a problem.
Are the rules different inside the boundary, outside the UGB, land use rules?
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole variety of rules, and it all depends on where they are supposed to apply to. We're referencing the statewide planning goals and rules, which is the goal.
If I build something, I'm assuming up there there's two lines. If I build something inside this boundary line, outside the UGB, will the rules be different than if I were inside the UGB?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So we're applying a stricter set of standards on this particular measure.
The idea, yes, I believe that is accurate. And the idea here is, again, to protect the existing cities. This is not supposed to be an easy process, but it's supposed to be a doable process. That's the goal of this bill, to make it at least doable. Right now, the current way the law is written, it's undoable.
And AOC is not happy with the way this bill reads right now.
Mr. Chair, the clarification, when we saw Metro's boundary, we assumed, our assumption is that Metro's boundary relates to the urban growth boundary of Metro, which is, as noted, is somewhat smaller than the political boundary of Metro, which is larger. Mm-hmm. But their land use, their plans and their rules that deal with urbanization apply within the urban growth boundary. They do not apply outside that boundary. And so that is the distinction, and we believe that those rules, when we look at Metro's housing rules and those applying, if you annex a city and it's contiguous or within 3 miles, that's where it should be, and if you're beyond that, then other rules should apply.
All right, I feel like Senator Menace on this thing. We're going to close the public hearing on 2458 and open up the work session. Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A7 amendments.
Senator Brown moves the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2458. I think LC's going to come after us on this one. Everybody okay with the amendments? Yeah. Senator Menace?
Yeah, I'm not going to complicate it anymore. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Hearing no objection, so moved. Senator Brown.
Can I move the bill?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator Brown. Pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves House Bill 2458 as amended by the Dash 7s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Now you just have to get it signed.
Carrier?
Mm-hmm. Portland person.
Yeah. We want a carrier, a Portland person.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to carry it.
Okay, Senator Brown will be happy to carry it.
I do think that we will need to address the issue of what boundary that apostrophe S is referring, but I think they can handle that on the House side.
Yeah, I think once they get it back. There.
You mean the conference?
Yeah, by conference. Okay, where are we? 47. All right. Can we close that work session?
You could, again.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2458 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 487. The Putnam Bill.
Uh-oh.
We had the Beaver Creek Bill, now we have the Putnam Bill.
Wait a minute.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Putman. I'm a retired PERS employee, and I work here at the legislature during the session, and this will be my fourth session to serve as a committee administrator. It came as quite a surprise to me to discover that I was not an employee of the Legislative Assembly. current law lets those PERS employees who are employees of the Legislative Assembly exceed their 1,040-hour a year employment limit. But because I work for the Legislative Administration Committee, the law does not exempt me. Now, I'm not here for myself. I believe that there are a number of people who have the experience and, more importantly, the institutional memory to provide a benefit to the legislature, especially in this era of term limits. I've been encouraged by other legislators to try to get a bill like this passed so that persons with my experience and background don't have to bail on about the 2nd of July, which, if you go that long, is usually a very interesting time.
Yeah. This is the Catherine Buffet Law from 95.
No, with the Putnam Amendment to the Kathleen. Yeah, okay.
I thought we took care of it then.
Apparently not.
Good bill should pass. Aye.
Okay. Aye. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to assume that it's not a, there's no fiscal impact on the PERS system or on a, I assume there's not, but just a little bit.
What I see is PERS people are shaking their head.
Great.
Which way, left or right or up or down?
Thank you. That's all I need
to
hear.
I got this on the measure summary.
Okay,
we'll close public hearing on the Putnam bill and open up the work session on Senate Bill 487.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 487 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves Senate Bill 487 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered. Carrier?
Okay.
Yeah, let's make Senator Beyer carry it.
Okay.
Beyer minutes.
Fine.
Fire. No, I'm sorry. I meant Roger Beyer.
That's fine, too.
Yeah.
Even better.
Yeah, we'll make Roger Beyer do it. Am I? SJR. Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on SJR 40. Anybody want to talk anymore on this thing? You have anybody signed up?
I don't know.
Talk this thing to death.
Yeah.
Is this the one we just...
Mr. Hazelwood. Sorry.
We just introduced this as an LC like a week ago, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lee Hazelwood, and I live in Staten, Oregon. I am opposing HGR 40 and the Dash 1 Amendment. I testified before you on LC 3765. I'm opposed to it because of the 12-year limit. Personally, I would like to see it removed and not have term limits. I have handed out a piece of paper to you before about the United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, opposing term limits. I testified before that there was a bill floating through this hallowed halls about 18-year age people being able to run for this body. If this bill were to pass in 12 years, they would be approximately 30 years of age, and they would not be able to come back and serve again. I don't like to see someone from outside the state, and I'm talking about probably Virginia, who is spending a lot of money on television telling Oregonians about term limits. So I am here today opposing term limits and like to see that removed from here altogether. I know it'll take a lot of courage from this body to do that. I know on this committee there are younger members who, when their 12 years are up and someone in their district comes back to them a few years later after their children possibly are grown and would like to have them come back to this body, and they're able to say, I cannot because I've served my 12 years and I'm not eligible to run again. I don't believe that those people should be penalized by not being able to come back and serve. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
I think we got it, Lee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll close the public hearing on SCR 40.
I apologize to the chair for not raising the issue. We've been talking informally about the other option to doing this, sort of along what Mr. Hazelwood was talking about, was putting all three items on the ballot at the same time, which would be a complete repeal, keeping it the way it is, sort of the default, repealing it altogether or doing this. I guess I wonder if there's any interest in the committee in doing that at all.
Here's the.
I talked with legislative council about that, and Ms. Rutlinger said it could be done. I just never had an amendment prepared. I can go either way.
The discussion is get it across. But let them wrestle. You know, the date has always been an issue. Let them wrestle with that. And then have an in-depth discussion over the merits or demerits. I feel like my promise to them was to get it to them, because it's got to come back to us anyway.
Not if they pass it the same way.
It's altered anyway, or they toss in a few more things. So, I don't. Whatever the committee wants to do, but that's just kind of what I think I have made the room. I know there's an issue with the date. That has a small problem. But the comfort level from that other from what we saw and hearing, I think.
Mr. Chair, I know I'm a lone voice in the wilderness here on that issue, so.
I know there's another issue about doing away with it completely, but that's a pretty healthy discussion. And I feel pretty comfortable going to see that kick back. Unless you guys are really serious about moving it that way, it just delays this thing for some period of time, or if we want to add it.
We could do it on the inside. I don't know if you believe that would take place over there. There seems to be some energy around it. I think you could get an amendment.
Yeah, I think the energy
set up for the next time, but I can live with it. I think we owe the public the right to have a chance to vote on it.
I think, yeah. It
doesn't affect me one way or another.
You know, I think the in-depth discussion is going to take place. It's pretty confident. But I need one more vote.
I think you're looking that way. You got mine.
No, this way.
No, you need four, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Well, I got three. That's one of your three wants to vote for this thing.
What do you want to do? Y'all on that end of the bench.
No.
We're bringing two Democratic votes.
Not ready?
You're not voting? No, you're not. We're not bringing two Democratic votes.
Is Peter now?
Yeah.
Passed your bill.
It's a lifetime.
Yeah, you're carrying it.
Peter.
You're carrying it.
I heard.
I was thinking about the other option. That was all part of the
You're talking. That was
not in those first days.
I was turning on that. You want to run for that door real quick.
Yeah. Like,
up to you two. I do think, Mr. Chair, if there is interest in doing the other one, you could have an amendment in front of us as soon as the next meeting, if that's the issue. But.
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a courtesy vote to get it to the floor. So I'll give you a courtesy vote to the floor, but I will not promise to vote yes on the floor. An expert politician being on both sides of every issue. Friends over here, friends over there.
What do you want to do?
So I got a courtesy vote. I got two no's.
I told you a long time ago you had mine.
Yeah. Well, you guys are too squishy for me.
You want to wait?
Yeah, we're going to wait.
Take Miller changes the next.
If he shows up. But he's not here now.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
We have the other one drafted. I'm sorry, I was outside. What the other proposals are coming our way, or which?
Well, we haven't had in-depth discussions, and I think we saw from testimony last week that that's a very viable option. Whether we kick it out of here like that also as an option is the discussion that we need to have in further detail.
Mr. Chair, just to explain it, the other option that we've been talking about, and I think you were out of the room a little bit, was rather than just a repeal or a restriction just to 12 years, the internal legislature put three things out there, and we actually could write the pamphlet, voter's pamphlet. We've done that. We usually do that. That would say it's been 10 years. Here's the public's chance to completely vote on it, and we would give them an upfront choice to keep it the way it is, repeal it entirely, or restrict it to 12 years without specification of service in either house.
And you and I talked about that on the floor, and I think that's a good option. Mr. Chair, my only reluctancy on this one is I agree with Senator Courtney on the word lifetime and the word ban.
That's
settled in, and that's an issue for me.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what I would wonder is what some language. If we're going to wait, let's agree upon some language that we want to have come back.
And what do you want to have come back?
What I would like to put out is the three choices.
And one bill.
With that notion, in one bill. That would show up on the ballot in three choices.
I
may be misrepresenting, but Mr. Rutland, when I was talking to him, said you could do that. And he hasn't showed up yet. Usually they come running down the hallway when we ask this.
they don't let us too far from their side.
I assume you'd have to have three separate referrals in order to do that.
No.
Okay.
I believe he said you could do it in one. Hmm.
How could you vote for different things?
I would support moving this to the floor with a few other options to the floor. Mm-hmm. I think it's all a discussion with having.
What was yours, Peter? What did you want to see?
I made a pretty strong statement about the ban thing. You probably weren't here, but I remember.
So are you into the free ship?
I think that's fine. Yeah. I mean, another thing is, you're going to make this vote. How many times do you want to make it? I mean, the way it sounds to me, we're going to be voting on this thing several times. And I'm saying that this committee was the committee of original jurisdiction. This is the committee of original jurisdiction. This is where it's all happening. And let's do it in a way that if we're going to vote, regardless of how the vote's going to come, that we put out as many. You know, the ban was an issue. I didn't hide that, didn't I? I mean, I made a dramatic statement about the ban. Remember, I used the word how it was used.
It was very dramatic.
Well,
they usually
are. I'm trying to be a smart aleck. I felt very strongly about that. And, in talking to Senator Barr, the issue of choices is legitimate. And in a sense, those discussions are going on, then,
we got that coming down here.
I just think that if we can pull it off, that's a unique way to put it out in front of the public. It's a real reasonable second look where you're being very honest and say, you did this 10 years ago. Here are three things that you can do. You can leave it alone, or you can leave it the way it is, and you can make the other two choices. And that's not hiding anything from the public at all. It's putting it all out there.
Everybody. Are you a lawyer? I think I want you here.
Can I be
Senator Biden?
Have food.
There he comes.
Mr. Rutland, you're here.
She brought all the legislative council with us.
We're all ducking. What?
You? Me?
You have a big target right here. Yeah.
So. May I just check?
Or should we be in something formal here?
Maybe a work session. Something.
All right, we're a little bit of work.
Moving to something.
Just AR-40. Yeah.
May I?
Please,
Chad, we were sort of following up on the discussion on being able to put, can we put the three options on the ballot? for term limits, the three options being sustain what the law is now, which I guess is the default if you don't change it, but clearly put that out there so the public has a choice, change it, repeal it entirely, or make a minimum change to restrict it to 12 years without regards to service in either house.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's a complicated question, and when we discussed that, I believe I expressed some doubt about whether we could do that in one particular measure. It seems pretty clear to me that the Constitution requires amendments to be voted upon separately, so I believe you could send out three different resolutions amending the term limits provisions. The issue then becomes what happens if they all pass. Statutes now say that if competing or conflicting constitutional amendments pass, the one that gets the highest number of yes votes wins. I have some doubt about whether the legislature has the authority by statute to say that that's what the result is, but that's what the statute says. So at a minimum, I think you could send out three separate resolutions on term limits. The one that got the highest number of yes votes, well, first they would have to have more than a majority to pass. They'd have to pass. Then the one that got the highest number of yes votes would prevail under the way the statute is written. I'm still trying to figure out if there's any way that you could give the voters a menu, basically, to choose from in the way that I think that you're talking about, but I have serious doubts about whether you can do that given...
Can we put multiple measures out under one bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer,
so it would show up on the ballot as separate measures,
right,
in order, and then we could write the ballot text.
We pursued that approach last session as we discussed with some of the victims' rights issues that were struck down in the Armada case. We interpreted that case to say that they have to be presented so that the people vote on them separately, right, not necessarily that the legislative assembly has to vote upon them separately. So I think you probably could combine those three things into one resolution with language that says or directs the Secretary of State to separate them out exactly so that when they're presented to the people on the ballot, they're voted upon separately.
What are you gaining? Why don't you just put out three bills?
Mr. Chair, it also strikes me, if you're going to do that, is so you don't run into the problem Ted talked about of whatever gets the most votes, why not do the modify the 12 years and the lifetime ban? Just do, pass this baby out, and then do another one on the lifetime ban, send them both out for the November 2001 election,
yeah,
and don't mess with, you know, total repeal or leave it the way it is. Because then you've got, then you have to worry about the conflicting.
My thought was to try and do something unique and be able to write the ballot title, be able to write the voter's pamphlet and the statement so it was very clear there, shooting it at an election where you're being very honest and upfront with the voters and saying you really have three choices. I don't really care whether they're separate measures. I sort of assume they would be, but just so we can control the wording what I'm trying to do, or what intrigues me, is being very clear with the voters in the language that they have three choices there.
So you're ballot title shopping?
That would be it, yeah.
Senator Menace.
I think the difficulty with putting more than one measure on the ballot is that if one doesn't get a majority, or both of them don't get majorities, they're competing against each other, then neither pass, if I understand. I mean, you couldn't pass them 40% of the vote. Basically, you've got people split off.
Well, I think they show up each as independent measures.
I'm sure they do at the same election, though, but what I'm saying is the voting population is going to, could very well be split on either one, and the result would be you got a number of them saying no, another other set saying yes, but no, there's no majority anywhere, as opposed to having one measure that either goes up or down on the same issue.
I don't think that's the case, because I think the way Ted is saying that is that you would have a major, in essence, saying, shall we restrict it to 12 years?
I see. You're talking about elements.
And it's a yes or no, and the other one that, and you would more or less explain it in the summary statement. So you're getting a yes or no on both, on three, but...
So you're talking about voting about on each segment of term limits. Yay or nay.
Mm-hmm. And then whichever one, the way Ted explained it is, I believe, is whichever one, if they were all voted on, whichever one got the highest total vote, then would be in place. That's
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that would, the higher total vote thing would only apply if they conflicted with each other.
Which they would.
No.
Well, in theory, it seems like you could do something that, well, I mean, if you did keep the lifetime ban in one, and you repealed it in the second one, and they both passed, the ultimate version would repeal the ban because it wouldn't conflict with the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to look very carefully at whether you were creating conflicts in any of the two or three measures that you sent out, but it may be possible to send out a variety of measures that don't conflict with each other, and if they all passed, you'd end up with whatever that combination was.
I mean, are we where we're going to seriously look at those other options? Is that where we are? Everybody shake your head, yes or no. We're not ready to go with this one single today. We need to keep looking. John, is that a yes or no?
Wait, the question is, do we want to deal with it today?
Yeah, we don't want to deal with it.
I don't want
to. We got some other stuff that's in the mix now.
I would.
That we want to keep.
Yeah, I guess the question, Ted, is I'm ready to move something. Do you see your way clear that you could give us something by next Tuesday in the way of an amendment that would get us there?
That's on where we were trying to go.
Yeah, where were you trying to go?
I'm not sure, but
just let me know
I think
where.
He has adjusted.
why don't you two guys and whoever else sit down together and see what the... Yeah.
But I agree with the chair. I think time to move on this. If there's a way to do the other one, that would be my personal preference, but...
Sure.
Do we have bills coming over from the House that you're going to do?
No, they're waiting on us.
They're waiting on us.
They're waiting on us.
Yeah. Except for the, Mr. Chair, except for the bill that moves up the filing date and actually.
Yeah, that's
Mr. Chair, though, essentially, though, we're talking about, there's another amendment on the whole process we haven't talked about, and that is that if we don't like the lifetime element, then what is it? What's the period, the timeout time? I mean, what is the?
You got
that's a different option.
Third issue here.
Yeah. What? And I was joking with Senator Menace. We do 12 and 12. 12 on, 12 off. But I mean, what is it?
Well, let's.
Mr. Chair, I would be willing to.
You guys.
Bring something back, and if not, we got this one. Move on to.
Yeah, we got a simple, small one that we know what that means. So let's. Throw some other stuff out there. Okay. Thank you, Ted. Didn't mean to interrupt your work.
Sorry.
All right. We will close the. We're not ready yet. Okay. We'll close the work session, such that it was on 40, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 955. Keith and Phil, just a hearing on this one.
That is?
Yeah. Oh, I can have a. You guys stay there for a second. Yeah, hang on. We're going to close the public hearing for just a second and open up a work session for some committee bills before you have to go to the track meet, Senator Courtney. What do I have here? We got a couple of memorials. LC 4200 from Representative Morgan, a memorial for Women for Agriculture. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And LC 4215, which is another memorial, urges Congress to extend the current Canada-United States softwood lumber agreement. Discussion, objections, hearing none, so ordered. Pass committee bills. All right. Close that work session. Open up the public hearing on 9:55. For the committee, 9:55 is something that I've been working on that came out of kind of our discussions, well, I among several of you, out of our discussions about the total cost of the ballot title process, ballot title shopping, number of measures, a whole bunch of things went into it. A discussion with Justice Carson about the cost of the Supreme Court under the current statutes. Discussion with the AG's office about the cost of how we do business. So we tried to look at something that that may clean it up a little bit, may not, may be dumb, but what you have in front of you is just the initial stages of that discussion. So maybe if you could just give us a little background on where you think we were, where you think we need to go, or just what it looks like. You two guys are the ones most impacted. What I heard from Justice Carson, just for your information, about a 23% of their resources are in the battle title business. And then from AG's office, they've got 10 lawyers in some various manners and methods working on this stuff. So pretty healthy amount of resources involved in the system. If there was a way to try and work at that, that's really what we're looking at. So, Keith?
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Harper and members of the committee. My name is Keith Garza. I'm the senior staff attorney for the Oregon Supreme Court. With respect to the workload issues that Chairman Harper was discussing, I had provided some written testimony earlier to the committee outlining in a general sense the workload impact of ballot title review proceedings on the Supreme Court, both in terms of the personnel cost, time, and as a percentage of the court's written work product. I think probably to say that ballot titles consume 23% of the court's entire efforts probably overstates the impact. The ballot title review proceedings did constitute for 1999, I believe, 27% of the court's opinions. But when you compare the complexity of ballot title review proceedings to other cases that come before the court, I think it would be fair to say that although the impact is substantial, it probably doesn't rise quite to that level.
That's what your boss told me.
Sure. No, and I understand, and the numbers say what they are. I just don't want to leave the committee with a misimpression of how much time these proceedings consume. Now, obviously, if you were to talk to the court during the spring of an election year, at that point, the proceedings basically inundate and flood the court, and that constitutes the primary mission of the justices for at least a several-month period. With respect to kind of workload issues in general, I guess I see that as having essentially two components: the number of cases that come before the court that are of a particular type, and the nature of the review or the decision that's required. With respect to the former, number of cases, there were 92 ballot title review proceedings filed for the 2000 election cycle. There were, I believe, 45 such proceedings for the 1998 election cycle. If the current numbers are any indication, the Supreme Court should expect to receive at least as many ballot title review petitions as it did for the 2000 election cycle for the 2002 cycle. With respect to Senate Bill 955, I suspect that by removing the Attorney General from the drafting process, that more petitions rather than less would end up being filed with the Supreme Court. You would have essentially a partisan target title and partisan alternative titles. Exactly how much of an increase, I don't know. For fiscal impact purposes, I came up with an estimate of 10 to 25% increase, but I don't have a lot of confidence in that figure. The second component of the court's workload would be the nature of the review or the decision that would be required. This Senate Bill 955 would eliminate from the court the responsibility for modifying ballot titles that don't comply substantially with statutory standards. I believe that, again, by removing the Attorney General from the drafting process, the number of times that the court would conclude that a ballot title did not meet those standards would increase. So I think that probably on balance creates the potential for more opinions from the court. And my own personal observation is that it is the opinion drafting process that proves the most time-consuming. Whether there would be any savings in having the court draft opinions discussing alternative ballot titles as opposed to writing a modification for a ballot title, I don't know the answer to that. But even if there were a decrease in the work that was necessary from the court from an opinion writing standpoint, I don't believe that that there would be a savings in light of the additional number of cases. But again, it's hard to quantify that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
The whole guts of this thing was Justice Carson's idea of the beauty contest aspect of life. Is that still worth pursuing, or you don't see that that's going to make us any money or worth getting
well,
to?
Well, I think from the stand, and I think that's really all I can speak to is the standpoint of the court's workload. Certainly, a beauty title or beauty pageant type of scenario would have the benefit, I guess, of eliminating a constitutional question that's presently before the court in a case called Flanagan. I think it would depend on the nature of the opinion that would be required from the court, if any, under a beauty pageant type model. This Senate Bill 955 has two express requirements or potential for the court to have to draft an opinion. And then at that point, I think some of it, frankly, lies in the hands of the justices as to how much they feel they need to write or want to write on a particular case. I think there is a potential there for cost savings to the court by having either two options or multiple options in front of the court, with the court's job being to select one based on some legal criteria.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of his idea. How do you get yourself out of the opinion business? How do we get you out of the opinion business? How can we help each other?
That is a very good question.
I have an answer.
I'm not sure that I would have an answer for that one. I think it would depend. For example, with respect to ballot title cases right now, in which the court concludes that the Attorney General's opinion or ballot title does substantially comply, there's a very short opinion that's issued that doesn't take very much time. But when it comes down to actually explaining why the Attorney General's opinion, ballot title does not substantially comply, either modifying or selecting among alternatives, I just don't know how much the court will feel compelled to explain to the parties and to the public why it's doing what it's doing.
Okay. Senator Minnis?
Well, the answer to your question is you don't have to require ballot titles at all. It's not constitutionally mandated. It's legislative prerogative. It's a legislative statute. Simply eliminate the silly things.
Yeah. Okay. Any further questions? Bill?
Chair Harper, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us today. And Chair Harper, I want to commend you very much at the outset for your endeavor to try and kind of survey the scene and come up with some workable proposals. Now, we've understood through this attempt that the underlying goals of ballot title reform really are at least threefold. One, to eliminate or reduce incentives for filing multiple measures and essentially engaging in either ballot title shopping or changing measures and bringing different iterations of that measure that entail ballot title drafting and time and costly resources. To eliminate or reduce incentives to engage in litigation, which right now exists because that delays the signature gathering process, so there's a built-in incentive in the process right now to challenge because it stops signature gathering. And the third thing is to reduce the burgeoning Oregon Supreme Court caseload because they are, at times, as Mr. Garza said, inundated with ballot title measures. And I think all those are very laudatory goals, and I think that we'd be more than willing to continue to work in this process to see if we can come up with a workable resolution. At the same time, we believe, the Attorney General's office believes, on, for the record, Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time, we believe that whatever system that ultimately would be established needs to keep in mind that the ultimate result of this needs to be a ballot title that's accurate, impartial, because it is the ballot title that people use in the voter's pamphlet, and many people rely upon the ballot title that's in the voter's pamphlet to either enlighten the campaign or to help them make decisions in the voting booth or now the voting mail. Now, as we understand the effect of Senate Bill 955, it would remove the Attorney General's office from a vast majority of the ballot title drafting, which is the proposed initiative measures. It would leave our office in the ballot title drafting process for legislative referrals, and for those legislative referrals that then had legislatively drafted ballot titles, they would be out of the process entirely and not subject to review. And what this system does is, I don't think that it really addresses the goals that I'd understood to be underlying ballot title reform. I don't believe that it eliminates the incentives that currently exist for filing multiple measures. I think, in fact, if anything, this might exacerbate that problem to some extent, because there may be incentives in this proposal that would cause a proponent to submit a number of iterations of the same measure, hoping that a ballot title that they are allowed to draft will make it through the process. And that kind of segues into the safeguards that exist in this proposal. What it does is it puts the, and partisan is an overstatement because sometimes it is simply the most interested and knowledgeable people who might be the proponents who draft the ballot title, so I don't mean to say that everybody is partisan, but what the controlling factor would rely upon the vigilance of other participants in the ballot title process, those people who might be watchdogs to challenge that process or challenge the ballot title, and then ultimately, of course, to rely upon the Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter to determine whether something substantially complies. But unless the matter is brought before the Supreme Court under this proposal, the only participants who would have had any input into the ballot title would be the proponents of the measure. And I don't want to cast stones and suggest that people would draft biased or partisan ballot titles all the time or any significant amount of time, but there's always the possibility that that could happen. And unless somebody were to challenge it in the Supreme Court, it would go unreviewed. So essentially, this proposal would rely upon the vigilance of other parties, which I think would entail most likely the need for more active participation by everybody in the challenging process. And unfortunately, I think what that leads to is not serving the ultimate goal or one of the ultimate goals of reducing the expenditure of court resources. Because I anticipate that under this proposal, there would be more challenges that would be brought in the Supreme Court rather than less. And I think that it also would have a possibility of leading to additional expenditure resources from the court in the need to send a matter back and potentially have the court address it again without any involvement of any disinterested or impartial third parties. Now, I don't want to leave the impression with the members of the committee that the Attorney General's office either is interested in empire building and holding on at all costs to drafting ballot titles. That's not the goal. Nor is the Attorney General's office interested in running away from ballot titles. We're happy to do the work. We don't feel compelled to do the work. I think there are some benefits in having an impartial third party be a drafter and part an active participant in the process. Because what that does is at least give a benchmark at the outset to know that if for some reason nobody engages in the process enough to have challenged our ballot title, at least I think the committee and then the members of the public ultimately would have some assurance that an impartial third party had a piece of the process and was not a vested interest who is attempting to get something through the system. Now, I want to keep the door open certainly for continuing to look at this because you know, there I think there are some potentials out there that might be of benefit to look at. Some of the proposals have dealt with things like a major summary to circulate for the signature gathering process and some delayed mechanism to review ballot titles. Some of the proposals that are out there have been to have some kind of a threshold signature requirement filing before you trigger the ballot title process. Those are some conceivable ways of going about it. I was also struck with your comment about, is there a way of helping the court to get the caseload processed a little more efficiently or effectively? And one possibility that is there, too, potentially could be to look at the standards that currently exist in the statute for the court's review, what the ballot title needs to have in it and the level of scrutiny or level of review that the court gives to that. And those are things that we really haven't had a chance to talk about in any of the conversations, but those would engender probably amendments to ORS 250.035 or something in the actual standard that the court would apply in reviewing ballot titles drafted. And so it's, you know, I encourage the continued look. I'm just not sure that Senate Bill 955 furthers the goals that I think the reform was intended to accomplish.
Yeah, it's just not quite getting there. In our conversation, one of these versions, you're either out of it totally, i.e. AG, or you're in it 100%. There's no way we can really save you much time or money by doing pieces here and there.
Chair Harper, I think that's accurate because at one time one consideration was given to having our office be kind of an offshoot if we perceived a concern about a ballot title that had been drafted by another party. Two concerns about that. One is, as a resource allocation matter, that would require our office to be actively reviewing all of them to know. And secondly, if we're in only some of the challenges and not in others, I think it subjects our office to the claim of bias, even though I think it would be totally unfounded. It's if we're in part of them and not in all of them, that it has a potential for appearance of safety.
Just want to make sure I understood that. Senator Menes.
Okay. I sense nobody likes the idea of getting rid of these things, so I'm not making any headway there. What would be the problem with using binding arbitration? That in this model here, we have a ballot title submitted to the Secretary of State for public comment. There is public comment. Then the petitioner gets to rewrite it again. If the person who objected liked it, then it becomes the ballot title. If they don't, then it goes to binding arbitration. And you have a binding arbiter or an arbiter who hears the various of the case. Once they're done, they're done.
Chair Harper, Senator Menes. In fact, the proposal that had some of those attributes was one of the topics of discussion some time ago. I think some of the concerns that have been raised about that are as follows. Arguably, you could have two ballot titles that came out of that process, the two choices, neither of which met the statutory criteria of substantial compliance, and yet you'd be required to choose.
With what?
Well, there wouldn't be any standard for substantial compliance. Now, that would mean that you could end up with ballot titles. The choice could be rather disparate. They could be unbalanced one way or the other, and the only choices available to the arbiter would be choices that were unbalanced.
Well, I'm not talking about last best offer. I'm talking let the arbiter choose between the sides or blend them. But once the arbiter blends them or comes up with a ballot title, that's it.
Chair Harper, Senator Menes, that's starting to sound a little bit more like maybe a resident pool of ballot title arbiters, or maybe one proposal has been, could you not set up a separate ballot title court, so to speak, in quotes, with either retired justices serving or some other pool of respected citizens? Those are all possibilities. One of the concerns that our office has, however, is, you know, we have a relatively large pool of attorneys that we can call upon, not even just the attorneys who draft the ballot titles, but in many, many circumstances, our attorneys are in consultation with other attorneys in our office who have relatively more expertise, for example, in a tax area or whatever. Many of the proposals that we see are rather complex and complicated, and if you have only either, you know, participants who have a vested interest in the outcome or potentially, and quite often, you will see relatively inexperienced and, you know, not much access to professional services. I would venture a guess that many of the ballot titles would not be an accurate depiction of either the current status of the law or the effect that the proposed measure has on that. And I don't mean to be tooting our own horns, but some of these are very complicated and complex. And it takes a relative amount of expertise.
Senator Meyer?
Thinking back, Bill, on the, as we've kind of labored through this thing for months, the goal was to cut down the time demand, but there was also an end goal. I know that the Chief Justice was very, and the justices he expressed, were very concerned that they didn't think that it was appropriate for the court to be writing ballot titles. And they, as I recall, their question, I don't know that they ever made that determination, but there was some discomfort about that. One of the things that intrigued me about this was sort of the proposal thing that we got to where, you know, somebody writes the first one and others can submit other titles, and the court then has the option of finding one of those titles most substantially reflects the measure and substantial compliance, or if none of them did, I believe the Chief Justice said they needed the option to send it back to somebody to rewrite it. Is that a savings, having that? Does that take some pressure? I guess it doesn't take any if the AG was still writing the initial title and then it was appealed, and the court would have anybody could submit another title who was a party to the process. Does that take a load off the court at all? Does that get them out of having to write opinions?
Well, in some respects, I think, except for the back end, it's kind of what happens right now. The Attorney General's office submits the certified ballot title. Any petitioner, I think maybe indirectly under the statute, but I think the common practice is that the petitioner will submit an alternative form of ballot title, urging
that.
The court, no, this is how the ballot title should look. This is one that substantially complies. But at the end of that process now, if the court were to conclude that the Attorney General's ballot title did not meet the statutory standard, it then would begin the process of coming up with one that did. Now, you know, the extent to which it would draw upon the alternative titles that were presented to it and the advocacy of the petitioners would simply depend upon the quality of their product and their advocacy. So that's the present state of affairs, which is a rather substantial commitment for the court. Under the proposal, under a proposal in which the court simply would select, again, I think that would go back to the court making a determination either, how much it needed to explain its decision. For example, if there were five alternative titles submitted, the Attorney General's failed to comply substantially, one of the alternative titles submitted did meet that threshold. The four others did not. I question whether the court would feel obligated to both the parties and to the public and to the bench and bar to explain exactly why it was reaching the decision that it was. Would that entail less drafting and opinion work than presently is undertaken? I guess I suspect that it would, but it's a very new creature, and I'd be interested to see how it actually played out in practice.
So there may be a little savings under that approach for the court.
If I had to estimate, I would say yes.
Yeah, but you know, the end game of this was just that, the Supreme Court, if there's a way to get to the AG, where these titles come from is still, I think, just can't come from any place.
Chair Harper.
As long as they meet, you know, certain criteria.
Yeah. Now, Chair Harper, members of the committee, I've been struggling with trying to figure out, I mean, a way to lighten the court's caseload really, I think, is going to take some kind of a mechanism to winnow the number of cases down that they currently see from currently any and every proposed measure can conceivably go before the Supreme Court, whether or not that proposed measure will ever garner enough support to get enough signatures to get on the ballot. And the only workable mechanisms that I have heard discussed are ones that would put some kind of a signature threshold on that. The, of course, that brings into play a couple of competing policy interests, I think, that the harder you make it to get, the higher that threshold becomes, the more costly it is for a proponent to turn around and start the process over again if they ultimately receive a ballot title that they think they simply cannot live with. On the other hand, I don't know of any other mechanism that can winnow the number of cases that conceivably can go to the Supreme Court unless we set up an alternative dispute resolution mechanism and take it, you know, away from the Supreme Court. I'm certainly, you know, willing to continue to explore options about that, but I think in terms of reducing the court's caseload, that's the real critical juncture to look at, is how many cases will go there. I think the court's work in terms of remanding back with directions would be fairly similar to the workload that they experience now in drafting how they want it to read anyway.
Mr. Chair, that was only the reducing the workload and cost of both the court and the AG's office was only one of the goals that we started talking about. The other one was it's real clear that the timing process is starting to be a political obstacle, in which you don't want somebody to get something on the ballot, you challenge it, and you delay it for whatever time it takes for trying to get at that.
Chair Harper,
trying to expedite that process.
Chair Harper, Senator Beyer, the proposal that I have heard discussed that would tend to help on that front, I believe, would be ones where if you had some kind of signature threshold requirement to trigger the ballot title process, there might have to be some kind of a mechanism, a measure summary or some other description of the measure to garner that initial signature numbers of signatures that, you know, a 10% figure is what I've heard discussed. A part of that process could be that a ballot title challenge in and of itself does not delay further signature gathering, that while that ballot title process were running its course, that additional signatures could be gathered that would also count toward the signature requirement. Again, the higher the threshold level that you make on that front, then the more people you have signing whose signatures would be counted who didn't have the ballot title before them, that they actually knew what the final ballot title would read.
I tell you what we need to do. You know, we've been kind of fiddling around with this thing for a little while, and this hearing, I was going to try and hear a little bit more, but I'm just not comfortable that we got enough to, you know, for all due respect for those of you that really want to talk, I think we still need to wrestle with this thing a little bit more. If you have some brilliant ideas, you know, maybe give me a call, see where we go, but the goal is laudable. You know, the path is still pretty murky at the moment. But, Senator Minnis.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You mentioned some proposals that included dispute resolution or binding arbitration or something. Is there anything written?
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, not that I know of. I think those are only conceptual discussions about could you, you know, have a pool of resident experts, I don't mean it in the pejorative sense at all, but maybe of retired judges or some other pool of people to whom you could refer ballot titles. One of the proposals early on was an arbitration idea, and the arbitrators would also need to be qualified individuals with, you know, in whom I think everybody, all the participants in the process would have to have some trust.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, the people who are playing in this ball game right now seem to be fairly sophisticated.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, certainly some are, not all. And in fact, I believe Scott Tye from the Secretary of State's office, I believe, is here with you know, a couple of examples. He may not be able to give them today of proposals that have certainly by all appearances come from rather unsophisticated individuals. And we see them, they cover the waterfront. Sometimes they are people with good ideas that, you know, are not professionals, individuals who have an idea that they wish to forward all the way through very sophisticated participants who are able to generate signatures and many, many titles.
Is that because these people maybe don't have access to what they feel would be helpful counsel in terms of drafting a measure? I mean, we do get this from time to time where someone wrote theirs on the kitchen table or whatever else, but I mean, it seems to me that as a legislature, we should kind of open the door to legislative council, you know, to say, look, if you really want to do one of these things, bring it in. We'll at least help you, you know, conform it to what we think the law is. I mean, is that being done now, or?
That's available. In fact, we're going to hear a bill under those auspices sometime before we quit. It's gone through LC. We'll have a hearing. And that's available to anybody that's out there. Not really taking advantage of
it. You did that in 97.
Yeah. I said I was trying to balance the people that hate the process and the people that love the process, get something in the middle, and I don't think, I'm not even close, so.
But, you're working so hard at it.
Yeah, I said, the people that came to testify, sorry, I said, Becky here? Sure. Or call me up and see where it goes. Scott, you've talked enough, so thank you very much. And everybody else. With that, we will close the public hearing. Thank you, and we will adjourn.
Steve, did you?